Welcome to another episode of The Halal Gap. I'm your co-host, Sophia Alani, and I'm joined by...
Skander Atik, your other co-host.
And today we're going to be interviewing Wasim Stark.
Whoa, you never brought Hamada into the loop.
Unbelievable. Also, Hamada is here.
What's up?
Yeah, yeah. Can we just keep that? That's fine.
Yeah, that works. That's fine.
Sure, whatever.
All right, let's do it. Okay. He is a chart-topping artist and record producer whose hit songs have been heard around the world and his music videos have been viewed tens of millions of times on YouTube. As a producer, he's created hits for everyone from Quincy to Mickey Singh. And on top of that, he's also a seasoned ad executive and brand strategist looking after brands like H&M, Marvel, Paramount, and Viacom. He currently serves as the global brand advisor to Paper Entertainment. Please welcome, joining us from LA, Wasim Stark.
Woo!
Wasim, what's happening, man? How's quarantine, dude?
Man, I am the quarantine king right now. I am the principal, the lunch lady, the school teacher, and the nanny at Wasim Stark Academy. I got a badass 3-year-old daughter at the house. So she's just running my life.
Full time Mr.
Now.
Dad
it's
right
all
now,
good,
right?
Man.
I love it.
Full-time zaddy mode.
I love it. I love it. So let's dive in. Tell us a little bit about your journey. Tell us about how you first got into music production. Let's hear the Wasim Stark story.
Yeah, of course. So the origin story of the incredibly boring comic book that would be Wasim Stark is, I was born and raised in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and was there for the first 12 years of my life. And then... right after that, kind of moved to the U.S. with my family. And then, even in Saudi Arabia, I remember kind of always having an affinity towards music. So, when I finally did touch down in America, I think it was like that to me was like the real, that was the moment when I really kind of took to it like a fish to water. I started off DJing. I started off learning how to dance. So I started break dancing because that was like the only way I could make friends.
Where was it, like a class, like on the streets? Is this the Step Up question. Movie? Like, I don't know.
Like when I first moved to America, I had like a really, really hard time making any kind of friends because there was a huge culture shock. There was, there was all sorts of things that I just didn't really mesh with American kids. And so, music to me was like the one thing that I found common ground in. And so I learned like early on that like, oh, I can like do this little spin move and people will start paying attention to me and then I can start making friends. And so, I just kind of started watching music videos and would copy routines of like Michael Jackson and God knows how many other people from like that whole era. And that's really how I started making friends, was like, oh, yo, that's the kid who can like break dance, or, oh, that's the kid who can beatbox. And, eventually it turned into, oh, that's the kid who can DJ. And that really was like my way in to like assimilate with American culture was music, because I sure as hell didn't play sports and I didn't understand American culture. But music was this thing that like, fortunately, I had been exposed to in Saudi Arabia. I was exposed to, Dr. Dre and Snoop and all that in Saudi Arabia. So when I came here, I was like, I was already up to speed on that. So that was like my one way in. I think eventually from DJing, it turned into, and I'm giving you the high level, we can dive deeper into those transitions. But eventually from DJing, it went into ultimately creating my own music and doing my little remixes. And then after that, I just kind of turned into like a full-fledged songwriter and a record producer. So it all kind of happened very organically. I didn't just make the goal to be a producer. I started out as a fan of music, then became a participant, and then ultimately now
I think we would love to dive into those industry. Transitions. How did that happen?
I have two funny, not funny, they're actually really cool stories. When I was in Saudi Arabia, I remember I was like, I think I must have been like 10 or 9 or 10 years old. We just got like satellite TV, like the big ass satellites that you would put on your roof of your house. Yeah, the dishes, right? And you would get like American channels. And it was a huge deal. Because up until then, the only American programming that we would get in Saudi Arabia was like Full House. And so we were super excited. And so my dad set it up. And I distinctly remember this. I turned on the TV and my dad, like, you know, turned the satellite on or whatever. I turned the TV on. And the first channel that popped up was MTV. And the music video that was playing was Dr. Dre and Snoop, none but a G thing. And at the time, I had no idea what rap was. I had no idea, like, of genres or anything. And I just saw, like, I had never seen a car this big, like the Cadillac 6.4. And it was more skin than I had ever seen on women ever before. Like, I was
going to say, this is like uncensored MTV.
Bro, like, my senses were imploding. And I was just like,
yeah.
I had never heard people speak that way. You know, like, to me, like, English was spoken the way I heard my, like, like Arab teachers speak English, you know, and they spoke with an accent, you know? And so when I heard Dre and Snoop rap, I just thought that's how all Americans spoke. Like, so for the longest time, I just thought people just spoke like Dre and Snoop. It was like, yeah, what up, Snoop? Or you're like, when they were counting, is like, hey, yo, 1, 2, 3 into the phone. I just thought that's how Americans spoke.
That was the best impression. Snoop, yeah. Snoop. That was very impressive.
Yeah. That's it though. That count is all you get for Snoop. I don't
know. You don't keep going. You stop before it gets offensive. Nice. All right.
Yeah. Literally. So that was like my first kind of, like, you know, besides Michael Jackson and the Beatles and all that, like, kind of pop American music. But that was the first time I really kind of dove into, like, hip hop culture. And then the other story I would say is, like, when I came to America, my family and I, we settled in Chicago, in the suburbs of Chicago. And, you know, I, of course, was having a really hard time making friends, because, you know, nobody, you know, if you're born and raised here, you wouldn't know this, but, like, outside of, like, America at that time in, like, the mid 90s, I'm sure now it's probably more global, but at that time, like, sarcasm was a very American thing, right? Like, to say one thing and mean something totally other, like, that doesn't make sense to foreigners. So, like, I would come to school and people would be like, nice shirt, Wasim. Or they'd be like, hey, nice shirt, Wasim. And I, my dumbass, I was like, thanks, man. So, like, for the longest time, and this is, I promise, a sad story turns happy in a minute. For the longest time, they kept doing this. And then I got my yearbook, and everybody who was signing my yearbook would say, at the end of the year, you get the book and you get people to sign it. And all the people would say, hey, man, I was so sorry. I was so mean to you at the beginning of the year. And I didn't understand it because sarcasm was so foreign to me. And so I came home pretty bummed out. I was like, man, all these people were, like, making fun of me this entire year. And, like, I don't know, I think I'm pretty cool. And da-da-da.
Yeah.
Bummed out. So I flop on the couch and I turn on the TV. And you know, I think once again, like, I think it's like, it's fate or whatever. But, like, I turn on the TV and it's BET this time. And I see a brown Rolls Royce driving through a desert with two black guys. They come out of the Rolls Royce in matching velour suits. And for no reason, the Rolls Royce explodes. And then the music starts. And of course, it's Puff Daddy and Mace, Can't Nobody Hold Me Down. And I saw that entire video and I ran to my mom. I was like, Mom, I gotta get a velour suit. I grabbed her by the hand. I was like, just like that one. And she's like, what are you talking about? That's velvet. I was like, I don't care what it is. I want
this
is amazing. That.
This explains so much.
Bro, I'm not even bullshitting you. Like, there was that day and probably a portion of it still to this day. I spent that entire portion of my life I used Puff Daddy as, like, the model for cool. I was like, whatever he's doing, I'm going to do. And I promise you, I never had any problems making any friends. My life was great after I just modeled my cool after Puff. And it was incredible.
Love it. So how, I mean, we'll dive into specific projects later, but I mean, you know, while we're on the topic, how incredible was it to work with Quincy then?
Yeah.
Considering the connection with Puff.
Full circle moment, man. It was
no doubt.
It was a full circle moment. And Quincy, I think, is, you know, it was funny how that came about, because, you know, my wife sent some records to her friend whose husband was friends with Quince. It was just like 3-4 different connections away. And, you know, in the music industry, you know, like everybody knows somebody and they're like, yo, some of your tracks. Oh, yeah. I was like, man, whatever. All right, here you go. And I sent it to, I gave them to my wife, Irene, who passed them along. And I totally forgot about it. I didn't think anything of it. And, you know, in less than like 40 minutes, Quincy emailed me and he was like, yo, this is incredible. Like, we got to work together. And so we met up in LA, and just one of the nicest kind of down to earth dudes, that I know. And yeah, like when I met his dad, I met Puff, backstage at an award show, like it was definitely like one of those, like, you know, the world stopped and it was just,
yeah.
So yeah, man,
They say like you should never meet your idols, but was that a moment that it was like, yo, this was legit, or was it kind of,
yeah,
what was that experience like?
No, you know what? I agree with that, and to a certain extent. Like, I don't think you should like intimately get to know your idols, because then you realize they're just flawed human beings just like yourself.
No, it ruins everything. It ruins all of it.
Yeah. Like, you know, you put them on this artistic pedestal, and then you realize, oh, well, okay, all right, well, but when I met Puff, it was very different. It was just like, I met Puff in like the peak Puff Daddy moment, like, you know, the shades on, shiny suit, like blazer, toothpick in the mouth, you know, dapping everybody up, and was like, yo, Quincy was like, yo, this is Wasim, he produced my record, and he was like, yo, I like what you did. But and that was it. Just a couple words, and that was it. You know, and I've even when Quincy's invited me to his house for events and stuff, I usually try and stay out of, you know, Puff's hair or his friends. Like, I don't want to like be like, hey, I just, you know, I'm a real big fan. You know, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So like, what was that like having him tell you he liked your work?
Yeah, I didn't sleep that night. I was like, you know what? I'm just not going to wear any clothes either. I'm just going to
bask in the glory.
Yeah, I'm just going to bask in the glory. That is the compliment from my idol. And no, it was a milestone moment for me. And I was like, yeah, this is incredible. So yeah, it was huge. And it was a full circle moment. Yeah. And I've yet to tell him that story, the can nobody hold me down story. Mm. I'm saving it for another time, but I will.
Well, he's obviously going to hear this podcast. Yeah, so you got to tell him before this drops.
So you won't have to tell him. We'll do it for you.
No. So tell us a little bit about the process of making music. You know, does it just start with a kick drum and just a layer on top of it? You know, where do you get your inspiration for samples? I mean, what is the entire creative process like?
There's a lot of different ways to go about it. I think, you know, initially when I first started, what I would do was I would try and recreate my favorite songs. Like, I would try and recreate like a bunch of like Timbaland beats. And I was like, yeah, how did he do this? I'm just going to try and match this song. And the easiest thing to kind of recreate is the drums, right? Like, okay, here's a kick, here's a snare, here's a hi-hat. Let me just try and create that same pattern. And so I learned a lot from that. So sometimes, you know, producers will start with the drums, right? And just try and get a good rhythm going. Some people will start off with the chords, you know, if you play, right? You'll start off with chords and just try and figure out the right energy, the right mood, the right tone. Some producers who are, you know, just they're sample hounds. So they'll like dig for a sample, and then they'll find it and they're like, okay, I like this, but I'm going to slow it down. I'm going to chop it up, and then I'm going to throw it on this. You know, like they hear it in their heads before they even produce it. So there's 3-4 different ways to kind of get into the house. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's no right or wrong way to do it. I have done it each of those ways. Sometimes I hear a sample and I'm like, oh man, I already know what I'm going to do with it. And, you know, I start with that. Other times I'll just hear a kick drum and I'm like, yeah, that's a bounce right there, man. Like I'm gonna rock with that. That's a bop, you know? And I literally will just sit there and listen to it for like 40 minutes. And like the people in the studio are like, bro, it's just a kick drum. I'm like, no. It's in my head. I hear it. It's so much more. But so, you know, I think it's about creative vision. It's about hearing the record in your head before it is kind of created. And I think that's also the most frustrating part, because you hear it in your head and you're like, yo, this is going to be this sample. When I do this, when I do that, da, 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 it's going to be incredible. And then you spend like 4 to 6 hours just trying to do your idea justice. So it's a pretty frustrating process. But you know.
Yeah. Do you have like more, have you done more classical training for your production, or is it strictly just like, you know, trying to recreate mm-hmm. sounds in different programs that you're now more familiar with?
Mm-hmm. It's something that I've, so to, short answer, no, I haven't been classically trained in like any sort of music instrument, like at all. All of my stuff is done by ear, and I hear things, and you know, like being in the studio with me is one of the most uninspiring things ever, because I'm just there like as somebody who's obsessed with music, and I'm just like tinkering and I'm putting these 6 notes together. I'm like, ooh, that sounds good. And then I'll move on to the next 6 notes. So it's a very like, you know, I'm not like Pharrell or like Ryan Leslie, or like just you get in the studio and boom, you know, beats and music just starts coming out of the room. Like, no, I think that to me, I think is like the lowest common denominator that I think all producers have, is at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you're classically trained or you understand music theory or you know how to EQ some sounds. It's, you know, it's your ear and your taste level and your ability to kind of have that vision. You know, like Puff didn't touch a keyboard in his life, right? Like, but he was, and I've worked with artists that have been in the room with him, and they're like, he just kind of like, he quarterbacks the entire session. He just sits there and he's like, nah, sing it this way, sing it that way, do it this way, do it that way. He hears it in his head, and you know, he kind of coaches everybody to kind of get to that level. So I think that to me is what I think is the most important thing, is having creative vision.
And have you ever had trouble bringing your vision like to fruition?
Yeah, every day. Every day. There is not a day where I'm not frustrated. Like I think Paul McCartney, I think it was him, and if it's not, I apologize, but I think he had a quote that said, he said like, I hate the process of creating, but I love the feeling of having created. And that's it. Like, you know, you start off really excited about an idea, and then you get into it and you hate yourself for like 8 hours. And then at the 9th hour, the 10th hour, the stars magically line up and you're like, oh, this is incredible. You know? So it's like, I think emotionally it's a draining process. But you know, you do it long enough, you know your skill set, and you know that you can kind of pull through it. It's just a matter of time, right? So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to get a little bit more personal now. That's cool. We got to start with the obvious one. Tell us about the name Stark. Where did that come from?
So the name Stark came from two places. Originally, I wanted to kind of, as a DJ, my name was something else. I'm assuming you guys want to know what that
DJ is. Flawless. Yes.
DJ Flawless.
Damn.
Yeah. No,
that's a high bar for yourself.
Modesty was not in my cards in my early 20s. And that's not even about like any, it's just, I used to be obsessed with Mortal Kombat, and like, you know, if you like the game without being touched, you get Flawless Victory. And I was like, that's a great album name, Flawless Victory. And I was like, I'll just be DJ Flawless. So that was that. But then I eventually wanted to kind of rebrand myself and lose the DJ moniker. And so I was like, I'll just go by Wasim Khan. And but for me, it was, and this is a separate discussion, but I think for me, it's very important to kind of separate the artist from the person. In my mind, I compartmentalize those two worlds very separately. And so I couldn't just go with Wasim Khan because that's who I am with, around my family, around my parents. So I had to be something else. So Stark came about when I looked up the name, what Stark meant. I was like, oh, Stark is like something that has a very, it's a unique contrast. It's something that's unmistakable, unmistakably yours, right? So when something is Stark, you're like, okay, it's unmistakably that. And so that's the quality I really wanted to have in my music to say, okay, cool, it's Wasim Stark. But then secondly, you know, that transition happened right around the time that, you know, Marvel as a brand was just taking off and Iron Man movies were coming out. And when Tony Stark came out, I was like, oh, I like that and I heard that name before, obviously through comics and stuff, but when Robert Downey Jr. brought that character to life, you know, I pulled a lot of those elements into the persona that is Wasim Stark. So it's kind of coming from both. It's a representation of the music, but then also a lot of those characteristics and qualities that Tony Stark, the comic book character has, I've tried to kind of incorporate those.
Yeah.
So like, how is Wasim Stark different than Wasim Khan?
Oh man. I think Wasim Stark, it's so weird talking about myself in third person.
We can do a Beyonce Sasha Fierce thing, yeah, if that helps.
Yeah, no. I think Wasim Stark is just an exaggerated version of Wasim Khan. You know, I think Wasim Khan is obviously, I think I'm much more boring and I'm much more structured and safe in the choices that I'm making because I have a wife, a daughter, a family, you know, like I have that to kind of, and you know, it's a much more kind of calmer, laid back version. Wasim Stark is, you know, kind of like, did you guys ever see Pacific Rim?
Of course, man.
Yes.
So you might have, right? So Wasim Stark is like an oversized robot that Wasim Khan controls. That's the best way I can describe it.
Gotcha. It's interesting you bring that up because, you know, I was going to ask you this, and it ties in exactly with what you're saying right now. Because you're a brand executive, right? Like marketing is what you do.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know in your like social media presence, like specifically with your Instagram, I feel like it's got kind of like a life of its own. You engage with your followers in what I'd say is a pretty unique way through your confessions and, you know, catchphrases that you do. Is that Wasim Stark or is that Wasim Khan? Like what is...
That's 100% Wasim Stark. That's, my wife hates Wasim Stark. Just, there is nothing funny about Wasim, like... There is not a video, a snap story that she finds funny. She's like, this is stupid. I've seen this movie before. But Wasim Stark. I think like, you know, a little bit louder, a little bit funnier. And it's not to say that it's not a part of who I am. You know, it is. I just think, you know, and that's all, you know, like some of the best actors kind of say, you know, you draw. When you're putting on a performance, you draw from within. And so, you know, when I'm doing these videos and skits and engaging with people, it's still me. It's just kind of taking the small part of my personality and just kind of magnifying and amplifying it a little bit for the purpose of entertainment. That's what seems to
start. I mean, it's highly, highly entertaining from a viewership perspective. It's good stuff. We've had a chance to talk to a number of Muslim artists on more of the film side of the creative world, but not so many on the music side. So I'm wondering, is the community of Muslim music producers strong? Do you find that it's collaborative or is it very fractured and kind of everybody's doing their own thing?
I think my experience is not the truth. It's just what I've seen. For me, my experience has been that it's pretty fractured, and we're kind of all off kind of doing our own thing. I think for a variety of reasons, there's just not that many of us, you know, kind of operating within, within the scene of like mainstream, and, you know, whether it be hip hop or pop or what have you. So there's just not that many musicians, producers, songwriters, artists that are Muslim that I've come across. So for me, the experience has been pretty disjointed and fractured. The ones that I have met are, you know, there's no ill will. They're totally down to collaborate. But I think I think film has seen a bit of a, they've seen mm-hmm. like a bit of a renaissance as far as like Muslim and you know, yeah. the brown community has really kind of stepped in as far as actors and comedians and all that. But I think musicians and artists mm-hmm. are still, I think, a bit fractured, because you have there's Muslim and Desi, right. there's Muslim Desi musicians that are only making Desi music, right? And then you have some very, very accomplished musicians that are quietly kind of tucked away in the corner making Bollywood music. And then there's people that are three or four artists that are Muslim and are in the mainstream. So we're still kind of spread out. And that's just been my experience. And it could be different. There might just be a whole gang of Muslim musicians that don't want to talk to me.
But no, you know, you just touched on something with Seem that yeah. I was, you know, I'm curious about, because a few of your tracks have taken inspiration from like Bollywood or South Asian yeah. roots. Probably most notably is Bad Girl, which has, mm-hmm. you know, tens of millions of listens. Mm-hmm. But then separately, you've got a number of more mainstream English language tracks. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you very consciously wanted to do, that so that you weren't being typecast as just a South Asian artist, or, you know, one that's just making South Asian music and beats, or was that just something that's kind of naturally progressed?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was a deliberate kind of shift. I think, you know, as a person, I think I've always been a fan of Desi music. I still am. Like, my Spotify is like incredibly fobbed out. Like, all my playlists are like Bollywood Connection and Bhangra this and that. You know, like, it's all that, you know. So I'm a fan of that industry and that entire sound. You know, after Bad Girl came out, it was like lightning in a bottle, and, you know, it caught fire. You know, and everybody that approached me after that record came out, and it was a lot of artists that approached me from that scene, from the Desi South Asian music scene. Everybody just kind of wanted, they were like, yeah, I want like that Bad Girl vibe. I want that bad. And it's like, but that record is out already. So like, I want to just do the same thing over again. And it was very clear that like, they just wanted to kind of replicate that.
Yeah.
And you know, when I looked at kind of the trajectory of my career, you know, 10, 15 years out, and what success looked like, it didn't look like performing at, and no disrespect, it didn't look like performing at weddings and accepting like British Music Asian Awards. It didn't look like that for me. For me, success looked right. like American Music Awards, Grammys, Billboards. That's what it looked like. And that's ultimately what I always wanted to do. Desi music, just something that I genuinely just had such a passion for. And mm-hmm. it came very naturally to me. And so, you know, I deliberately kind of pulled the brakes, made a U-turn, and went back to the starting point, and, you know, took the other fork in the road towards kind of producing mainstream R&B, American kind of hip hop music. And that was, you know, that was a long, long, long drive up. You know, 'cause truth be told, I could have just flipped that Bad Girl momentum into more.
Yeah, totally.
You know, but, you know, I think it was what I needed to do, and it was the right move for me, because I just couldn't see myself making that for the rest of my time in music, you know? But yeah.
And so did you like find in your music production and in the creation and stuff, like, how do you balance yourself as a producer between that and the singer? Like, how do you make sure that the two of you are mm-hmm. getting the spotlight at the times you each need it? And how do you kind of create that in your work?
You know, for me, that's a great question. I think for me, you know, I walk into a session, a recording session, a writing session, or a production session. I walk into the studio with the understanding that what we are creating is bigger than, you know, each of us. It's the collective sum of all of our efforts. And so, you know, if everybody does what they're supposed to do and everybody is kind of operating with the goal of let's make the best music possible, I think there's plenty of shine, there's plenty of spotlight to go around. And with regards to me and what I do, I think I equate the role of a record producer to that of a film director. You know, like he or she is really kind of overseeing everything. There isn't one specific thing that they're responsible for. So for me in a studio, sure, I'm producing the beat and writing, co-writing the melodies and the lyrics, but I'm also looking after to make sure that the artist is, you know, comfortable enough to deliver the right performance. If he or she is, you know, saying it or singing something with hesitation, I'll take them out and I'll coach them into like getting back into that pocket, right? Or, you know, if the engineer is, you know, not kind of mixing down the sounds the way it needs to be, I'll kind of oversee that. So, you know, there's a number of different hats you wear as a record producer, but I think ultimately your job as the record producer is to produce the record by any means necessary. You know, so whether that's you actually composing the beat, sometimes I've gone into the booth and like done a bad recording take and been like, yo, like just follow this, just sing it the way you would actually sing it, but follow this rhythm, because artists can't get the rhythm, right? So there's a lot of things you just kind of have to do as a producer. But to me, I actually do the opposite of what you were suggesting. It's like making sure everybody gets a spot. I actually take myself out of it entirely. I'm like, I am hired by the creative idea, right? So I am working for the creative idea that is this record. So I got to make sure that this song is the best that it could be. And that's worked out pretty well for me, because that way there's no egos, or, you know, there's plenty of time for that in the music video or, you know, your Instagram or whatever. But when you're in the second, we just got to make sure that this product is the best that it can be.
Yeah. And do you think that's something unique that you bring? Cause I feel like, again, not having done it myself, I could be way off base, but I wonder if like it's really hard, because like this is, as much as you're there to bring like that, like you're hired to bring that vision to fruition, like it's still your work. So like, how do you put aside kind of that I don't want to say ego, but I guess ego is the best word. Like, how do you put that aside to kind of make sure that you are there for quote unquote the right reason? Are we on The Bachelor? You know, and to just like make sure that you're doing it the way that it should be done rather than how you want to.
Yeah, I think it's I think a certain level of I would say, you know, confidence and awareness as opposed to ego. I think being confident in your abilities and your ear and being aware of how you're communicating are incredibly critical. So yeah, there are times where like we will literally repeat one line for like 60 minutes, like until you get it right. Like we will keep doing this. And the artist, I think, you know, having established a good sense of trust and having established a good relationship with them, they know you're not doing it to be a hard ass. You're not doing it to kind of to be a dick. You're genuinely there to make sure it's done right. And, you know, I give artists whatever break they need. And, you know, I give the engineer whatever time he needs to, you know, make it sound the way he or she needs it to. So I give everybody the autonomy and the path that they need. But at the end of the day, we do need to finish the record. And they know that. I think everybody kind of understands that. Also, I think when you step into a recording session, I think everybody knows that the buck stops with the producer, you know? Like they know, like everybody, after the take is done, they're not looking at the engineer. They're not looking at their manager. They're looking at the producer like, yo, is that good? Can we move on? You know? So I think there is a little bit of that established role there already. But yeah, I try not to be a dick as often as I really do.
That's great.
It's a good life motto in general, you know?
Get it done. You know, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a minute about leadership because so much of leadership is about you got a top down mentality and you got to get it done. Blah, blah, blah. And it's sure, but you don't have to be a dick. Make it happen, get it done. But I've always found that being able to speak everybody's language is so much more important than making sure they hear you.
That was a great quote. I'm going to write that down to remember that.
Put my photo in black and white.
That's the next thing I'm printing. Yep.
Mark that for the teaser for this episode right there.
Yeah.
No doubt. That's the clip right there. Hamada, make notes. That's good stuff. So staying in that same kind of vein of sharing the spotlight, have you seen the Chris Rock stand-up Tambourine?
Yes.
Okay. So you know how he talks about how in a relationship, one person's got to play tambourine sometimes, the other person can sing lead, and you got to be able to switch it back and forth. You know, your wife, Irene, is also a very successful person in the public eye.
Yeah.
How have you guys found that balance between one person singing lead sometimes, the other person playing tambourine sometimes?
Yeah. I played a tambourine all the time. I play the tambourine all the time.
Play it with pride, play it with confidence. Yeah.
No, man. I think in a, being married to, in being married, period, I think is such a balancing act. But I think when you both are creative and you both are kind of operating in some sort of public eye or public figure, or you both in some, Irene obviously is much more established in her industry as a beauty influencer. I think it's kind of respecting each other's spaces and respecting each other's kind of opinions. You know, for the longest time, early on in our marriage, we would always kind of go back and forth about what to and not to do on social media, because I came from, I was an ad executive and I literally do this for brands day in, day out. But on the other end, I think, she is a content creator and she's an influencer. So nobody knows this better than her, so there was a lot of clashing of opinions. And this came to life in the most kind of obvious way some people may or may not know this, but Irene actually directed and produced the music video for Bad Girl, for Mickey Singh's record Bad Girl. So,
Cool.
So, we storyboarded the entire thing out, but, the production, the actual shooting of it, and then the editing was all kind of handled by Irene. And so there was all these kind of opinions that I had about what it should and could look like. And then she, of course, was, the practical person that was saying, nope, can't do this. Nope, can't do that. So it's a lot of kind of just, I think at the end of the day, it's kind of understanding each person's kind of circle and okay, this is my circle. That's your circle. We will eventually overlap in this Venn diagram here, and this is where we'll play. But these are the songs that you know how to play, and these are the songs that I know how to play. We may do some duets every once in a while, but that's your set list and that's mine. And that takes a long, long time to kind of really understand and learn. Mm-hmm. I'm still learning her set list. and we're 7 years in. So yeah, man, I think it's just, it's always a balance. It's always, a discovery and a journey, but I would say that I think it's just understanding and respecting each other's spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. And then I guess we're getting close to the end, but just because we've covered, the music and everything, we kind of wanted to talk a little bit about your day-to-day work. Mm-hmm. And Sikandar mentioned your role as an ad exec. So you currently work with Paper, who were the ones behind the Kim K breaking the internet back in 2014. So can you tell us a little bit about that? What does your day-to-day look like? How do you balance that with the music production?
Yeah, absolutely. So I work as, I'm currently with Paper Entertainment, or Entech is the holding company that acquired Paper Entertainment. So all the projects that fall under NTech, which is a company founded by Tom Florio, who for those who aren't familiar, you guys should Google Tom Florio. He's a absolute legend in the fashion and media business. Former SVP of Vogue, former president of The New Yorker, GQ, the list goes on and on. And so he acquired Paper Magazine, last year. And that's right around the time that I was kind of brought on a few months later to really kind of help advise and counsel on some of the global projects that NTech is taking on, as well as some of the US-based projects that Paper Entertainment is kind of looking after. So my specific role deals with brand strategy, creative approach, creative development, paid media planning, social architecture, really just kind of, and that all of course rolls into business development. So whether it's sitting down with clients to pitch a new campaign, or it is, being in other parts of the world trying to set up new operations around media and entertainment, I'm kind of sitting on that on those discussions to really help guide them in a productive way.
Was it in that capacity that you you were part of that project for that music festival in Saudi, or is that separate?
Mm-hmm. No, that's so, right. So NTech, completely separate from Paper, NTech was brought on to really help amplify some of those things that were happening for the Riyadh Festival. And the music festival was separate. It was a separate initiative that we didn't have, that NTech was not involved with. So I think there was like MDL Beast. I think that's what it was called, that music festival. What I was looking after was called Riyadh Season. And that was more around like, fashion, entertainment, food, restaurants. There were some concerts, but it was concerts. It wasn't like a festival. So it was incredible for me. It was a full circle moment. When I left Saudi, like I said, we just had Dish Satellite installed, and it was a privilege to be able to listen to American music. And now to come back, 15, 16 years later, and see kids my age when I left, kids my age are now listening, are now getting to see Migos and Russ perform live. And they know all the words. Like, the internet has made the world so small. They know all the words, they know all the dances, so it was definitely a full circle moment for me.
Very cool.
That's very cool.
All right, man, we are going to end with a few rapid fire questions, if that's cool. It's first thing that comes to mind, okay? Like no thinking, you just got to go with it, all right?
Ooh, all right.
Okay, we're going to start easy. Okay, New York or LA?
New York.
Jay-Z or Beyonce?
Jay-Z. Get me started. That's not...
Jay-Z, ooh, is this a hot take?
It was the king, bro. Like Beyonce's having her moment, right? Sorry. Beyonce's having her moment right now, but nobody remembers like the 10, 15 year run that Jay-Z had. Like, we're not. We'll put some respect on the king's name.
I think people remember, but like I went to go see them in LA and like they would not have sold that many tickets if it was just Jay-Z.
Well, yeah, now, yes. But like you compare Jay-Z at his peak to Beyonce. Look, I'm going to get in trouble, but like, because I'm not going to mess with the Beehive. All respect, but I'm just saying, I don't want to see Jay-Z memes, Let the man ride the jet ski. You know what I'm saying? Like, let him ride. He did his time. He's tired. Just not envy.
Amen. Okay. Amen. Preach. Preach, bro. Okay. Next question. Favorite type of potato? And we don't mean like type of potato as in like type, but like French fries or baked potatoes, so on and so
mashed.
Forth.
Mashed.
Yes.
Can I do tater tots?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can. Most rewatched movie.
this is not by choice, it's by circumstance. The most rewatched movie in my house is Jurassic Park. My wife,
is Horton living in your house right now? What's going on?
Bro, I'm so mad the two of them are friends, but like my wife has like the film taste of like a 12-year-old boy. She like Furious, Jurassic Park, Armageddon. Like
those are all amazing. Like I don't know what you're talking about.
After like the 70th time, you know, like how many times are we going to see the dinosaurs take over? You know, it's fine. Let's but to answer your question.
Okay.
Jurassic Park. Okay.
And last question. Like, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to clarify. This is like Jeff Goldblum.
Times. OG Jurassic Park.
OG. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
OG Jeff. Chest out everything.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
Amazing. Okay. And what is the best show to binge watch on any streaming platform right now?
Money Heist. Don't at me. Don't at me. All right. Read and actually, I would say don't do the English dubbing. Go, it's on Netflix. Don't turn the English dubbing off and watch it in. It's in like the way it was originally recorded, and turn the subtitles on. It's incredible. We're watching right now. We're like 3 seasons in, and yeah, it's great.
Love it.
All right.
Wasim, thank you so much for joining us, man. Really appreciate this.
I'm so glad we did this, guys.
Yeah. Thank you.
Where can people find you?
You literally can find me everywhere. It's just Wasim Stark, WASEEMSTARK. Find me, follow me. Apologies in advance for what you're going to see, but I hope it brings a smile to your face.
Amazing. Thank you again, bro. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find us online on all social media platforms by searching Moskers Film Festival. See you next time.
That was good. That was really good.
Thanks. I'm getting better.